fourth case of the day, United States v. Trujillo-Castillon. Mr. Tricoli.
May it please the Court, my name is Matthew Tricoli and I have the distinction of representing Geraldo Trujillo. We are here today because the District Court, in violation of United States Sentencing Guidelines subsection 5H1.10, impermissibly considered Mr. Trujillo's ethnicity and national origin in imposing a sentence that exceeded the advisory guidelines range by 7 months and that which was recommended by the government. Both parties substantially agree that you cannot consider an individual's ethnicity or national origin in imposing sentence. What we do disagree on is the standard of review in this case and also the nature and character of the judge's remarks. First, I would like to address the standard of review. There is a circuit split on this issue between the 2nd and the 11th. I did not see anything in the 7th Circuit which was controlling. The Second Circuit has a line of cases, mainly from CABA, which hold that de novo review is proper even where there is no contemporaneous objection below. And the Court reaches that finding because a defendant is understandably reluctant to suggest to a judge that an ambiguous remark reveals his bias just as the judge is about to select a sentence. In our society, in this day and age, calling someone biased on the issue of ethnicity, national origin, race, is a very serious charge to level at an individual, especially when that person is about to impose sentence upon you. Now, the 11th Circuit, I believe, rather flippantly disregards this in holding contrary by refusing to carve out what they label a cowardly counsel rule, stating that counsel does not need to object contemporaneously. I think that the Second Circuit's reasoning on this issue is far more persuasive and that this Court should take de novo review as to whether national origin, ethnicity was considered in this case. And also, CABA goes on to state that if you agree with us, that there should be a resentencing by a different judge. And that goes in large part to Justice Frankfurter's statement that justice must satisfy the appearance of justice. In order for that to be done, there must be an unbiased observer to correct this error. Second, moving on to the nature and character of the remarks in this case, the Court will see in the record that from pages 8 to 10, the government makes several remarks, perhaps Mr. Trujillo's views on theft and how they're different from other offenses where people get hurt or die, which I think is a very easy distinction to make, and in fact the law supports the fact that there's a distinction in those type of offenses, could be based on his Cuban nationality and heritage. The government goes on for around 2 pages, also referencing permissible factors, such as the defendant's extensive criminal history. Again, the Court knew this. It was a criminal history Category 4. The sentencing guidelines took that into account. But that was a consideration that the Court could consider. That is permissible. However, the Court's statements that this is your lifestyle, it can't be blamed on
Cuba. You've jumped over what the defense said, though. Doesn't defense counsel make some pretty specific reference to the national origin matter also?
I believe the defense counsel was basically trying to deflect and mitigate what had happened already from the government. And it seems to me that that was already ratified by the judge and not stopping the government in the tracks for bringing in impermissible issues that were repugnant to the defendant's constitutional rights into the sentencing proceedings. Counsel attempted to deflect that, and counsel, again, the law here is that it cannot adversely impact the sentence. Counsel tried to make mitigating arguments in an attempt to deflect. They were relatively brief. But the Court says, when I see this record, which, if you take that statement, it starts with a permissible factor, when I see this record. Now, if the court goes on to impose sentence merely based on the record, we're not here today. However, the judge goes on, when I see this record, it's kind of reminiscent of, I was on the state bench then in 79 when the Mariel people came over here and created crime waves all over the place. When Castro emptied his prisons and his psychiatric wards and Jimmy Carter took them all in. That creates an appearance that Mr. Trujillo and his fellow Cuban defendants are these others, and they're kind of in the same boat as the, so to speak, as the Mariel people who commit all these crime waves. And really, this statement can really be put in context when, on page 22, the court goes on to state, it's like a group of locusts descending upon a field and devouring the crop. I don't think it's an inept analogy when you see locusts coming down into a state and then taking what they want and destroying the land, so to speak. That's a very powerful biblical reference to others coming into the land of us and destroying, devouring. It's very impermissible, and it goes to them and us. And even if you were to adopt the government's view contained in their brief on page 17, that the statement, when I see this record, refers to an indoctrinated attitude that is okay, that it is okay to steal, an immature failure to accept the American way of life. Even under the government's analysis, I believe that's highly improper, that is based on ethnicity and national origin. To accept the American way of life. So what is the converse of that? The Cuban way of life? It still runs afoul of the law, even if you adopt the government's view of that issue. And I would liken this case to a case cited in our brief, USA versus Eduardo Franco, where the judge stated that the defendant should have stayed in Colombia. They don't have too much regard for judges. They only killed 32 chief judges in that nation. I'm glad I'm in America. And in that case, the court, in relying on Justice Frankfurter's statement that justice must satisfy the appearance of justice, held that the judge need not actually be guilty of such prejudice, but just appear to be. And in this case, I would argue that the judge made sufficient remarks that show that he was guilty of that prejudice, but certainly that there was an appearance to the average observer, the reasonable observer, that there was bias. Barring any questions, I'll save my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Cantor?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Paul Cantor. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Let's start, if we can, with the standard of review. I'd like to address that very briefly. The standard of review that the government suggests this court accept is the one that was referenced and is cited in our brief. It's the Rodriguez case out of the 11th Circuit. I would just like to briefly reference that the 11th Circuit rejected the Second Circuit's kind of waiver, if you will, of the plain error doctrine in cases such as this because, in their own words, they find it demeaning to both lawyers and judges. And I would submit that that is, in fact, correct. We practice in this profession, and I would submit that both lawyers and judges are used to hearing objections. It's not always pleasant, and I'll be the first to tell you, quite frankly, that in my now 31st year of practicing, before various bars, including this one, for well over 25. It is not pleasant standing here for the first time in my career, having been accused of bias. It's not pleasant. Nonetheless, I accept the fact that it is part of our profession, and I'm here to argue the case. So I say those things because Rodriguez is a correct statement of the standard of review that this court should apply. There was no objection to the comments made by the judge at the time sentence was imposed at this time in this case, and as a result, the court should be reviewing for plain error. Now, let's talk a little bit about the substance of what happened. Today, as yesterday and tomorrow, it will be true in state and federal courts across this circuit and, in fact, across the United States. Prosecutors and defense attorneys will be arguing in mitigation and in aggravation the history and circumstances of a defendant's life. And judges, in imposing sentence, will be weighing, at least in part, as at least in federal courts it is required under 3553 of Title 18, that they consider the history and characteristics of defendants. In this particular case, that is all that was done. Mr. Trujillo was not sentenced because he was Cuban or because he was an immigrant. He was sentenced because he has an extensive criminal record. And, according to the pre-sentence report, in his own words, he reflected certain attitudes that suggested to the court, and I will well admit to me as the prosecutor on the case, that he was presented a very high risk of recidivism. Those are the reasons that the comments were made, and those are the reasons that Judge Randa, in this case, imposed sentence. The only difference between what happened in this case and what happened, as I said a moment ago, in every court across the country facing a criminal sentencing, is that instead of the court looking in this case at the experiences and the influences from Chicago, whatever neighborhood of Chicago it might be, or whatever neighborhood of Milwaukee it might be, or South Central Los Angeles, or Washington, D.C., or Door County, Wisconsin. The only difference between looking the influences that were considered in this case and in those cases is that Mr. Trujillo happened to have been born in Cuba. The influences are the same. And to suggest, with all due respect, that the court can't consider those influences and the history and characteristics that develop from those influences because this defendant was born not in the United States but in a foreign country is, I think, a bridge too far. And I respectfully submit it is a bridge too far. Your Honor, as you pointed out very well, defense counsel himself, in his arguments to the court, I won't read the whole thing, but it says, I'll read part of it. I've been to Cuba, and there's a criminal regime in charge down there. That doesn't make what he does here right, but there's a certain just attitude, if you will, that when you steal in Cuba, unless you go up to your neighbor's house and steal, that you're pulling a Robin Hood-type act. Because the government is corrupt, and so many people get indoctrinated into that. And when they get here, they're immature. They don't accept the American way of life. They have a hard time adjusting to it. They find that it's easier to turn around and make easy money this way, easy money from theft or fraud-related cases, as is the case in this particular.
And the court certainly addressed that in talking about his lifestyle couldn't be blamed on Cuba, but then he went a little far, didn't he, when he said it's reminiscent when the Mariel people came over here and repeated crime waves all over the place, when Castro emptied his prisons and his psychiatric wards and Jimmy Carter took them all in. I mean, when you look at that frame, everything else, when he says unlike Cuba in America, private property is sacrosanct, it's not government property. I mean, that to me, that language that I just cited to you is the language that I think goes too far.
And unfortunately, I will be the first to concede that I am in the unfortunate position of not being able to tell you what was in Judge Randa's mind. I can't do that, obviously. But I think it is important, and as we cited in the brief, Judge, yeah, I think it's very important to note that he starts that statement by the words, and counsel referred to them, as this record shows. He's referring to the defendant's record, his life's history, and primarily his criminal record, which is extreme to the extreme, if you will, in this particular case, particularly with regard to the offense before the court. This was a credit card fraud case where the reference I submit, I was there, I heard the judge say it, the reference I would submit to the locusts was a reference to the defendant and his co-defendants. They came from Miami. They came to the eastern and western districts of Wisconsin. They came for seemingly no other reason that we know of other than to blow through, if you will, to burn out, as we say in law enforcement, 21 different credit cards. And we could track them from the stores that they went to. They actually got up in the morning and went from store to store to store and burned out these credit cards across the Eastern District.
And this defendant, on his way out of town, didn't they stop at a Capital Grill and spend over $10,000?
They did. In one night, they spent over $10,000.
This is the night before he leaves.
That is absolutely correct. And so I submit that the reference to locusts is directly in reference to what the judge was seeing with regard to this defendant. And that's the important point here. I submit most respectfully that the important issue here is this defendant. He was sentencing this defendant. The two Second Circuit cases, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing the one correctly, Leung, I believe it's spelled L-E-U-N-G, and the other one, which is Kaba, K-A-B-A. If I remember the facts of both of those cases correctly, the judge, in imposing sentence, in one case, Kaba, I believe, was actually asked by the assistant United States attorney to do it, but in both cases, I believe, the judge made a statement that they were sending messages to the specific communities from which the defendant was coming. In Kaba, I believe it was the Ghanaian community, and in Leung, I believe it was the Chinese. And if I recall correctly, the judge said, I want to send a message to the Chinese community, or I want to send a message to the Ghanaian community that this activity will not be tolerated. That's not what happened here. The judge wasn't making a comment about a community, was not sending a message to a specific community. He was sentencing this defendant for a crime spree which was the culmination of years of similar crimes committed by this defendant
to
Wisconsin.
And certainly I get all that. It's just I'm troubled by that statement. I'm not going to repeat it again, that why, you know, psychiatric wards and Jimmy Carter, you know, if someone's listening and wondering, you know, what's the basis for the sentencing, and didn't he make that statement right before he imposed the sentence? He then went from that to talk about criminal history, because we have an above-guideline sentence here, don't we?
We do. My recollection is that statement came about in the middle of his discussion of the defendant's criminal history. I could be wrong, but it was not immediately before he imposed sentence. It was about in the middle of the discussion of the criminal history. And he did go above the guidelines, and he explained why he went above the guidelines, because in this particular case, this defendant had already stood in front of judges on four separate criminal charges, not to mention all the revocations that he faced, and was basically the longest sentence he received was 12 months. The judge essentially said, enough is enough. Thank you. I'd ask you to affirm the sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Cannon. Mr. Ciccoli?
Certainly, the majority of factors under 3553, the permissible factors, were considered. The government cited to United States versus Pepper, a recent case that basically supports the proposition that a court should consider the individual characteristics of each defendant. But you still cannot consider those things which you absolutely cannot under 5H1.10, which is race, sex, national origin, creed, religion. These things you cannot consider. So if that's even 0.1% of the calculus, it requires resentencing. And regarding the point that that defense counsel raised the issue as well, in Kaba, both sides argued about the defendant's national origin, and that court found that it was no less error because it was invited. Even if it's in response, the court considered impermissible factors. That's why we're here, and that is why we need a resentencing. Nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Coley, do you remain, originally Mr. Walsh was appointed in this case. Do you remain an appointed counsel in this case?
kind
the
of
only reason I say it is,
I'm
is,
kind of in limbo on that. I
was going to give you an additional thanks for accepting the appointment, which I do whenever we have an appointed counsel. That's the only reason for the inquiry.
I'm filling in for Mr. Walsh, who was appointed.
Oh, you have our thanks for your representation.
You.
And Ms. Skinner, obviously, we thank you. Case is taken under advisement.